Thanks, everybody, for attending the Special Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs. Before we get started, could you do the roll call, Leona?
Briefly.
Yes.
Here.
Here.
Here. Thank you. First off, we'll pick up HB 371, which is an act establishing the Alaska Veterans Endowment Fund and providing for credits against certain taxes for contributions to that fund relating to other tax credits for certain contributions and providing for an effective date. And with that, we have in the audience Pat Crothers with AVAC, Joe Stadler with VFW, Carol Carroll with DMVA, Chuck Hardiment, DOR, and John Jinks with DOR. Also, do we know if Laddie is online yet? Laddie is not yet online. So, with that, Carol, did you want to start, please?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Carol Carroll, and I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. And the bill that you have before you would indeed establish Alaska Veterans Memorial Endowment Fund. And the purpose of the fund is to have income from that fund to maintain the monuments and the memorials that we have around the state to our veterans and to our military. Some of the memorials are in pretty bad shape. In the past, the veterans themselves have volunteered their time to keep up the memorials. We have already, at this point in time, collected about $125,000 from members of our community in Alaska. They have donated money to this fund. The fiscal note that you have before you is for an additional $125,000 for the state to match that amount of money so we can get some seed money into the endowment fund. Businesses would be able to get a tax credit for any of the donations that they would give into the fund. There are some limitations on that, and I've given you a sectional analysis that describes, you know, what that tax credit is, and the Department of Revenue here is here to answer any questions that you may have about the tax credit portion of the bill. Section 4 of the bill is the description about the fund. It would be managed by the Department of Revenue. Income off that, which is determined by the Department of Revenue, would be allocated to the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs by the legislature, and from that point on, we would work with veterans groups to grant money to them for the maintenance or construction of military monuments and memorials. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would answer any questions you may have for me.
Representative Murkowski.
I understand from talking not only with General Oates but with some of the veterans that really there's no state money that currently goes towards maintenance of any of the memorials or the memorial.
That's correct.
And that the only way that they've been maintained to date has been through volunteer efforts. How many veterans memorials do we have in the state right now?
Could I ask Pat Carruthers to answer that? I don't know. I know we have quite a few.
Do you know the number of memorials we have in the state at this present time?
Right now, I think it's 78.
Could you come up front, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and distinguished members of this committee.
I'm Pat Carruthers, chairman of the Alaska Veterans Advisory Council. And to answer Representative Murkowski's question through the chair, the figure is about 78 right now. There are one more that I know with $2,000, not appropriated funds, but promised funds, there's going to be another one. So that's the figure we're working on now. My experience with the Archie Van Winkle Memorial Fund down here, administering that, we're working with $2,000. We've got, we've done repairs. We have had professional cleaning jobs. We've put in benches, trees. We're working off the interest. And that's a $2,000. That's what we had left over after the construction and emplacement of that particular memorial. At $250,000, I'm sure we could, there's no question in my mind that we can support 70, 80, 90 different memorials. They're of different nature. So the longevity on these particular memorials, one's a road. DOT takes care of that anyway. Several of them are, there are memorial highways. Plaques on a bridge. The largest expenditures, in my mind and based on my experience, will be replacement factors, whether lightning strikes the Glen Allen memorials, you know, destroys the poles and whatnot. That's the big expenditures, but how often is that going to happen? But this will indeed afford the opportunity to maintain these memorials in a dignified manner and one which they are really richly deserve. These people, the veterans that are commemorated here, did much to honor this country. They bled and they died in many cases for this country and for this state. Don't let anybody forget or think that this country is above that. Other than Pearl Harbor, the only Medal of Honor that was awarded for action on the continental United States was right here in Alaska, the Martinez, out on ADAC. So it can happen here. It touches home. And all we're asking for is the means in which to honorably recognize those heroic efforts that these memorials recognize. Places of remembrance need to be maintained. For Alaska veterans who took care of America, it's high time we took care of them. Now, the public has, private contributions, has put their money up, $125,000. We're asking for $125,000 in matching funds, and we will live off that interest, which will come out to about $12,000 a year. That's the interest. And I'm completely satisfied that we can maintain these memorials in an honorable way. By using these funds in that manner. Before I'm finished, sir, I would like to bring the committee's attention to the fact that we have in the audience Joe Stadler, who is a World War II veteran and was one of those that brought LST 325 across the Atlantic Ocean from Greece to Mississippi. And we're very proud of him. He's a native of Juneau. He now lives in Alaska, in Ketchikan, for quite a while. But I'm very proud to introduce him to you.
Thank you, Pat. And we're proud to have you here in front of the committee. Pat, is there any realizing that, the memorials have been taken care of through, volunteers, you feel that the $12,000, if 125 was to match the 125 that you already have, that you could conceivably do all the maintenance on these memorials?
I'm thoroughly convinced of that, Mr. Chairman. I really am. Based on my experience right down here, this memorial here has been in existence for almost 7 years now. That's 7 years track record, and I keep track of the numbers. But there's other memorials right here in town that haven't been touched. The USS Juno, for instance, memorial. The large brass plaque with the names of everyone that died in that occasion. Hasn't been touched, hasn't been shined, hasn't been cleaned or anything since then. There's nobody, no committee behind that one. So that's what can happen. And I think that we would be dishonoring them by not letting this go through. And so we're asking that this committee would favorably pass on Bill 267. Favorable comment.
This is for the record, 371. Right. 371.
One of them flat bottom boats.
Any other questions of Carol or Pat? Seeing none, I did have a couple questions. I'm curious, and maybe would have either Chuck or John talk about the tax implications from corporations and what may or may not be either deductible or be allowed under the current bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chuck Harlemer. I'm with the Department of Revenue.
I would just be interested in, in the sectional that we have here. We talk of 2, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, and 16, the parallel sections dealing with oil and gas production taxes and pipeline transportation property taxes. And I'm just curious as to what kind of... I see that they're eligible, but I'm kind of curious as to how they would work.
The credit allows a combined credit, no matter what tax you apply it against, of up to $150,000 per calendar year. And similar to other education tax credit that we currently have, taxpayers can choose which tax liability they are liable for to apply it against. The taxes involved are insurance premium taxes, corporate income tax, oil and gas severance tax, oil and gas property taxes, mining license tax, fisheries business, and the fisheries landing tax. And mechanically, they would get a credit against the state tax liability and a net deduction on their federal return for their contribution less the amount of the state tax credit that they receive.
Representative McCaskey.
Thank you. I'm looking at the transitional language under Section 17. And trying to understand how the amounts are available for appropriation. And it looks like the first year, it's basically 5% of whatever you have in the fund. And then, if I understand correctly, every year from there on out, you take a 3-year average, and, you know, you're basing it on the market value of the fund for the immediate preceding 3 fiscal years. Yeah, and then based on the average ending balance of the fund. But is there a 5% limit on the payout for the succeeding years, or is it just in that first year?
Through the chair, Representative Murkowski, I'd like to come up and discuss the financial outflow section. We would handle the tax credit in the tax division. Treasurer would be better able to answer those questions.
Thank you. Thank you. My name is John Jenks. I'm the Chief Investment Officer for the Department of Revenue. In the investment features of this bill, really set out an instruction for the department to invest this endowment to earn 5% after inflation over time, so that if inflation is 3%, we'd be trying to earn something like 8%, so that it is explicitly an instruction to inflation-proof this endowment, so that 10 years from now, Mr. Carruthers will have the same economic power to maintain those monuments that he has today. And the transitionary language really says the monthly balance for the, we build up to that 3 years. So the first year you start out with the monthly market values for the first fiscal year, and then come to the second fiscal year that this bill would be effective, we would have, this fund would have been in existence for 2 years, then 3 years. So it builds to that 3-year rolling average. And the reason that that 3-year average is in there is to provide some smoothing so that there's, markets do go up and down, and that over time this will smooth things out so that the veterans will be able to have a fairly stable expectation about how much resources they'll have year to year by really having a very stable payout over time that is 5% of the market value, average market value of the endowment.
Okay, so that was my question, was whether or not the 5% of the market value is what you're capped at. And that is what you're saying. Okay. Do you have any estimates then, based on as I understand that the private contribution of $125,000 is out there now in the anticipation of a state match of a similar amount, what do you anticipate would be available to Mr. Carruthers and his group on an annual basis then?
Well, approximately $12,500 in current purchasing power each year would be available. So, you know, next year maybe it's 12,007, but the inflation adjusted would be approximately 12,500 per year.
It's not, you don't anticipate that it will grow to incredible amounts. I suppose if we have great markets, that possible. But
a great market could certainly grow it, or I suppose if a lot of taxpayers elect to, or people donate to the fund, and the fund gets bigger because of additional donations, then that money would increase as a result of the fund becoming bigger because of subsequent donations. But just for the original 250, we did not anticipate that growing to some large amount.
So you're trying to basically model this after somewhat similar to PFD?
I think the PFD sort of wants to go here. This legislation is really, Mr. Chair, very typical of current endowment type language that you see sort of not only individuals who might be setting up endowments, but, you know, other states. And it's kind of the current thinking of the best way to do this to provide for the most efficient investment and stable payout for these endowments.
Representative Murkowski.
How many other endowments does the Department of Revenue manage?
There are, this would be the sixth specific endowment that the department manages, and this language is the model language that, as other people have come and said, we want to do that. We're focusing them on this kind of language something very similar to this kind of language is what was used for the power cost equalization fund, which we think of as an endowment as well.
And your portfolio in terms of how you're managing it depends on, I'm assuming, the timing of the need. I guess you're just looking at this would be an annual payout, so you'd have the flexibility to do some investment tools to make some money here.
Representative, because we have all these endowments and other funds that the state does manage, we have a real scale of efficiency that allows us to invest these very efficiently, yet still have the liquidity to be able to provide on an annual basis for the payout. So it works very well.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You said this would be 6. Have the other 5 averaged in the 8+? Percent
over
the last 2 years, I'm thinking about.
The last 2 years.
I'd like to give you my portfolio if you.
Unfortunately, I cannot give you that kind of news. They've done fairly well, and several of the other endowments don't have this language. In fact, Senator Terrio has sponsored some legislation that would change the sort of rules of the road. As they're set out in statute for investment of the Children's Trust and Public School Trust to make them more efficient, as efficient as this. So right now, over time, we think this endowment, absent that bill becoming law, would actually achieve superior long-term returns because of the flexibility that's incorporated here.
Good. Any other questions?
Just real quickly, Mr. Chair. The $125,000 that's in here, and I don't know whether either one of you can answer the question, but been obtained from private sources, will they be able to avail themselves of the tax credits that we're talking about?
Through the chair, Representative Murkowski, no, the contributions are already made, and qualify for the credit would have to be made in a year in which the bill is effective. I'd like to add to your earlier question about how much could possibly accumulate. When we go through the taxpayers who participate in the Alaska Education Tax Credit Program, it's typically because you only get 50% of the first $100,000 as a credit, but 100% of the second tend to go all the way and contribute the entire $200,000. And for the full $150,000 credit, 95% of all, or at least 90% of all of the tax credits we get in terms of dollars are maxed out at the $150,000 level. And it's a very tight-knit group of taxpayers that tend to have strong charitable giving programs in their own right. So we would likely see the fund, if it grows, to grow in substantial steps, 150 at a pop.
Yeah, this is more set up for bigger contributors than people like myself and Representative Green. Thank you, gentlemen. With that, I think I'll hold the bill till next week, but I do appreciate your testimony. Pat, I do appreciate you being here. I do appreciate Joe Sadler being here and gracing us with your presence. It is an honor to have you here. Whether you believe it or not, it is.
You're talking to Marine now.
I know.
Oh, okay.
With that, I'd like to go ahead and move on to HB 324. And today we'll take up items 23 through 28, which is the Department of Environmental Conservation. If I can spit that out. And I believe we have Mike Conway here with ADEC. And Mike, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mike Conway, DEC, Statewide Public Service Division Director. And I'm here today to speak to the line items that Mr. Chair just mentioned concerning the DEC aspects to HB 324. I provided a copy of a summary sheet for our environmental health laboratory with you. That is an item that is not listed for funding from HB 324. It's listed there as a critical component of the Homeland Security net. I believe Health and Social Services has other laboratory items within there under their items. So the Environmental Health Laboratory, however, is sitting in HB 51 and is before both finance committees as a bonding measure based upon its standalone merit. So there's a breakdown to for you just to see the functions of the laboratory. It has a peacetime mission that also carries over in the event of a weapons of mass destruction attack, to where the department would have a capability to look at the food sources and water if there had been any contamination of those items. Give you an idea that this is, since 911, it's not strictly food contamination. Water contamination is not something that's just limited to 911 kinds of attacks. There's a pending case currently against somebody who has threatened the Anchorage water supply system that is going through criminal proceedings. And then there is was a case in the Dalles, Oregon several years ago where 751 people were made sick through a group that was trying to affect a local election, contaminated a salad bar, and they were trying to make people sick so they didn't make it out for the election. Anyway, these are the sorts of things. The laboratory also engages, you probably heard in the past, whenever we've had tourist buses that maybe they've stopped somewhere and a number of tourists have been sick, so it gives us an opportunity to test the foods. There's a lot of work. The peacetime mission goes further along the lines of testing shellfish for different diseases, and dairy inspections are performed at tests at the laboratory are done that allows Alaska's milk to be sold commercially and to the military, for instance. So there's several. The sheet goes into more detail on that. But it is, again, it would be an instrument, a tool that could be used in Paris using an agent to attack food or water supplies.
Mike, and realizing that, as you say, it's set in finance right now, I know that we discussed this last year probably at fairly great length in different committees that I was in. And I would guess that, and I'd like your response on, like, 25, you're looking for six additional response corps staff. where are we looking at, or if you could kind of give me a rundown on them, where are we looking at housing these people and what jobs are they actually going to accomplish? If we do or if we don't do this safety laboratory, were they involved in that particular scenario, or are they in a different department somewhere else?
Mr. Chair, the positions, the six positions and the 24-hour response capability is not associated with the laboratory. It would be part of DEC Spill Prevention and Response Division to augment the existing staff and capabilities for response to hazardous materials incidents and spills. These six people would be used to work with communities around the state, DEC and other agencies in preparedness for the capability to respond to weapons of mass destruction incidents. Currently, we have a peacetime function where we do this for oil and hazardous substance spills anyway, and the resources presently available are dedicated to doing that at the current level of activity. So when you bring in the possibilities of weapons of mass destruction, you bring in new expertise that's needed, new equipment that can address that, analysis work, risk assessments, and that sort of thing. So this group of six is not related at all to the laboratory. That there are existing laboratory staff. They're in an existing laboratory now, which has been determined to not be adequate any longer, and that staff would staff the be existing staff would do this laboratory.
That's the one in Eagle River or Wasilla.
Wasilla, yes, sir.
Wrigley's or someplace.
Sir.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On 25, ongoing for fiscal year 03, looks like $100,000 per person. What? Who are these people? That's a pretty fair salary. That's more than Joe makes.
By far. $100,000 is a one-time cost for equipping the whole group and training the group. The other amounts you see are for the personal services for the staff. The first $250,000 is for a half of a fiscal year, or the remaining of a fiscal year if the supplemental is approved. The $600,000 is the ongoing annual amount.
That's what my question was. That's $100,000 per person.
That's typical when you look at the salaries, equipment, and training with any responder, $100,000 per responder.
What kind of training, what kind of people are these? That's not equipment, that's salary, isn't it?
Yes, sir. These are environmental specialists. It's the current rate we have for now for oil spill responders and hazardous chemical responders. We get into to maintain the capability to operate the equipment, there's continual training required for different levels of hazmat response, and that's the cost, the going rate for a environmental specialist spill responder.
What do these do, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Green.
We've got these now, and they've been on for a couple of years. What are they doing? I mean, they've been trained, and we haven't had a threat. What do they do in the in between threats?
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, they're responding to spills right now. The group that we're asking for here are not doing anything with weapons of mass destruction. This is done in anticipation of weapons of mass destruction attack.
Mm-hmm.
The existing group of responders are responding to spills. We get in the neighborhood of 2,500 spills reported a year. Within that, they have a ranking and an assessment process on the spills that they respond to. They coordinate with local people in response. I need to get my SPAR director to answer the specific questions of how many are doing what their caseload is, but they're responding to spills every day.
I'm confused, and that's the existing staff, but you said these people are not going to be an oil spill. These are going to be
dedicated to weapons of mass destruction response.
Okay, and so it's beyond training now. We're in the second or the third year. Are they going to be sitting around waiting for something to happen?
I'm sorry. Through the chair, Representative Green, they're going to continually operate with, you know, training communities, writing up the plans, repairing, drilling, exercising, all of the activities that as the fire department does waiting for a fire to happen. It's the same aspects, and they'll be doing that around the community. There's an unrelated, or there's a related item, not in DEC's, but if you look at line 74, under the Department of Militaries and Veterans Affairs, they're looking to establish and equip level A hazmat teams in one in Southeast and one in Valdez. So that would make four teams that require considerable training, exercising, planning, just the typical emergency preparedness activities. So they're not going to be sitting around waiting for weapons of mass destruction incident to happen necessarily. They're going to be preparing.
So you say that a majority of the time they're going to be training either city or municipality people in weapons of mass destruction or, they're going to work with municipalities as far as any special training, is that?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. They'll work with municipalities. They'll work with the federal agencies. There's a civil support team under the National Guard. There's a whole network of responders that, in the event of a weapons of mass destruction attack, that they would be working with.
Representative Green.
I'm sorry to keep boring in on this, but okay, now we've got a problem. How do they fit in with these other agencies? Are they, excuse me, are we duplicating here, or how do they fit?
Chair Representative Green, it's, nobody duplicates services in a response. They all come together through the incident command system.
Mm-hmm.
So they would be trained in an event of incidents and training for incidents. They would be assigned specific duties as part of a joint incident command system, a unified command system, if you will. So they all, same as we do for North Slope spills that you're familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
You go through and you have the federal OSCs, you have the state OSC, and you have people in their different components that are doing that. So they're not a standalone, trying to have a standalone capability for the state. It's be fitting in with local, federal, and other state agency responders.
Are these going to be geographically spread, or are they going to be stationed in one area?
We haven't gotten to that point at figuring out assignments of where they are. I would have to get back to you on that as far as the locations they are. I could speculate, but it's not in my division, so I'll wait and have the SPAR director.
I just wondered how the number six came up. If
we were looking at the additional aspect is the State Emergency Coordination Center activates during the time of a response, and they will require a 24-hour watch capability there, too. So we were looking at having a capability to be able to augment somewhat the four response teams that are throughout the state, and we would have two positions to work in the State Emergency Coordination Center out of Fort Ridge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I'd like to go back just in one of your comments. You talked, and it doesn't have really anything to do with this, but you talked about 2,500, 3,000 spills a year that the current department's workload is.
What's reported to the department?
That's reported, but that's anything from a teaspoon of oil to
be varying amount.
Major. Yeah.
There is a minimum amount that's required for reporting of a spill, and it varies to whether it's a spill on land or a spill on water. So in some cases I don't have the number in front of me, but it's several gallons on land, for instance, before it needs to be reported.
Thanks, Mike. I guess 26.
Decontamination equipment for people exposed to hazardous materials, and I'd like to speak to 27 as well. It's the pre-positioning of decontamination foam and trailers. Both of these items are related to responding and assisting citizens who are potentially exposed to weapons of mass destruction, either biological or chemical agents. The targets for a lot of these attacks can be several thousand people, and there's no capability existing in the state to be able to get the decontamination equipment to them, get them cleaned up, showered up, destroy clothes, that sort of thing. So there's a two-way approach to this. One is that in the major areas of the population areas of Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau, there would be a fixed capability there since the population is there to be able to rapidly decontaminate people that are exposed in the event. And then you get into there's a deployment capability where we would have trailers and things that are airliftable to be able to get to They'll be located in the current place where the fixed ones are, but if you need to get into a remote community, if there's, happens to be some exposure there.
Could you explain what decontamination foam is?
Decontamination foam is a chemical. It's a foam that is used to spray on equipment, buildings, anything. It was used, for instance, when the Capitol buildings were affected. You go in and you just you spray it all over everything in the room to attack the biological agent, neutralize it, destroy it, and it evaporates. But it's more used to attack things where the chemical agents or biological agents are attached to things.
When you say went into the Capitol, you mean into Washington, D.C. Capitol?
Sir.
But apparently whatever it was didn't work against anthrax.
I hope it worked.
They had to go, Mr. Chair, they did have to go back in.
They did a bunch
of things
in
that
building.
It's just anything else, did they, I don't know if they applied it properly or if they got it in a nook and cranny, I don't know.
Well, I thought they did.
It is the state of the art for...
I can't remember what it was, what chemical that they ended up using, but I didn't think it was a spray, the final thing that they used. I'll have to check on that and see.
Killed
the whole plant. Well, that might not be a bad thing some days. But I guess in regards to the six flyaway decontamination sets, I assume that that's a set that's going to include all the materials that you think you would need in case of some type of biological attack.
Sure, yes, that would include the equipment. Basically, the equipment packages would be large capacity hot water heaters, inflatable shelters, tents, heaters for the people that are getting decontaminated, and then they have, with that goes mass decontamination, privacy kits. If people need to get cleaned up from that, so it includes that.
Does this also include, I would assume, suits and all the materials basically you would need to go into a contaminated area or a...
This is for Mr. Chair, this is for decontamination of the people affected. The suits and that sort of thing come under the other items for the responders.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm moving ahead a little bit. 28, you mentioned earlier about the person that's being prosecuted now for threatening the drinking water. Can you tell, or are you at liberty to say what it was that he either threatened to use or?
Mr. Chair, I have limited knowledge of it, but there was a threat by somebody who was angry about something and told some people that he was going to poison the Anchorage drinking water system, and so he was arrested, and it's somewhere in processing is all that I know, but it was just some, somebody who was angry about a certain thing going on.
Would that be... Could that be done in the reservoir, or would it be done somehow in the distribution system, or either, or both?
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, it could be both. And that's what these assessments would do is look at what are the inroads that somebody who wanted to contaminate the system try to use. And predominantly, we're looking at surface water, drinking water supplies, or very vulnerable, including the lake, for instance, is something that Municipality Anchorage, Department of Natural Resources has an eye on. In Juneau, there is some surface water sources, but the underground wells have a little bit more protection than that. So this would focus on those, do an assessment to see where people may have access to get into the system and have an effect to be able to inject it. Further is being able to have the ability to detect it. And this is just to do the assessment part of that.
Is there, dumb question perhaps, but is there any ongoing type testing now? Is it periodic or continuous? Or
Through the Chair, Representative Green, municipalities, particularly the, those of the larger population centers, are, have ongoing increased security and are testing. And in most cases, you know, given the conventional things that they test for, if somebody were to put something in, we don't know what all of the agents could be, and that would be part of the assessment, is to figure out if somebody's going to take an exotic chemical or something. But there's confidence that once we've been able to do that, and it may require the purchase of some equipment, but there is the capability to detect it if it gets into the system. We just have to bring that capability into Alaska, into the communities that could be affected.
Okay, your assessment then. You're basically, in my mind was somewhere else for part of that, but your assessment then is you want to assess most of the public drinking water systems.
You want to, excuse me, Chair, I'm sorry.
Big city.
Mr. Chair, we're looking at the large public drinking water systems, not every little one within Alaska. So we're looking at Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, you know, on the Kenai, wherever it is that the larger people eat. And this is to do an assessment that, let me check here for a second. Looking at our attempt would be to get federal funds to do it. We've heard that there are federal funds that the federal government's going to make available for this and equipment. And our approach, you know, some might say, well, you need to go out and you know, buy the security right now, buy the equipment and so forth. Well, we don't know quite yet what it is we want to buy until we've done the assessment. And we think that when the federal money becomes available, we expect that there would be federal money available for the upgrading of security and detection systems on drinking water systems. If we've got an assessment that shows that somebody has looked at these major threat areas, and we have the information that would lead us to make reasonable purchases and applications for that federal money.
Representative Murkowski.
How much are you going to be relying on the local the municipality? For instance, in Anchorage, my neighbor is head of AWWU, and for years I know the Anchorage water system has been touted as being one of the cleanest and one of the, they say it all like it's good advertising, and I'm sure it is very good. But in order to get these wonderful awards for this good, clean, safe drinking water, I'm assuming they must do their own vulnerability assessment. How would what they do to ensure that our drinking water is safe on a daily basis, how would that be any different than a vulnerability assessment?
Through the chair, Representative Murkowski, this would be, what we've done is worked with the municipalities, you know, and at one place have said that, you know, we would try to get the money to do that and would be passed out to them. They would, you know, the vulnerability assessments would be done under their direction. There's no, the way the current structure is, the local municipalities are responsible for their system. DEC provides some oversight, but they don't report to us. They're not subservient, and we don't direct them on how to do that. So our approach here was to take it just for statewide use, give it back to the groups, or we could work as a single, you know, get a single contractor to do it by pulling, you know, being a focal point, but it would be very much directed at the local level on how they do it, and it's not in addition to what they're doing.
So then I guess I'll go further and say, well, if they're already doing it, why do we need to give them the money? Or is there a different component when you assess the vulnerability? Is that different from what they currently do to ensure that the drinking water is safe?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murkowski, what we've been talking about this afternoon is for weapons of mass destruction bylaw, security, you know, upgrades in the mind of what's going on, but they haven't been addressing things for weapons of mass destruction.
I'm going to go back and talk to my neighbor. in terms of, you know, how we do test it. They must do a daily testing to make sure we don't have weird things coming down the pipe, and you would think that if you've picked up something that we can't even pronounce because we don't know this type of chemical agent, you would think you'd be able to pick that up, but maybe not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murkowski, they're testing for things that they expect. What we don't know what the biological agents would be or the chemicals that they might use. We need to find that out and then be able to see if we would be able to detect.
So it is a little different then. Thank you.
Representative Green.
We're on a rabbit trail, Mr. Chairman, but this is just for personal interest. What sort of things are you familiar with that you could contaminate, say, a water system like Anchorage? That, I mean, it's huge to keep it from being so minuscule by the time it got distributed that it wouldn't be effective. Would it be a bug, you think, or a poison?
To the Chair, Representative Green, I really don't know. Our first reaction when everything started happening was we'll be able to detect it. And then as on the federal level, the EPA started looking more into the kinds of agents that could be used, and then you could see people's feet sort of shaking a little bit, or, you know, they're sort of shuffling around. And so I don't know the answer to yours. I think, you know, the initial blush was that we would be able to.
Would or would not?
Would have been able to was the initial blush. But their EPA is now working to do more trainings and workshops and you know, looking at these things at the national level and starting to communicate that out to the owners and operators of the drinking water sources. So there's something more to it than what we initially thought.
Things we can't pronounce.
Yeah,
that's right.
You don't want to pronounce. Mike, thank you.
Yes, sir.
Also, off net, we have Wayne Rush. I don't know if Wayne wants to speak or not. Wayne, are you still there?
Still here. Thanks for the opportunity, but I don't have anything to add.
Okay. We appreciate you tuning us in anyway.
We're out.
With that, that's all we had on the agenda today.
I have a question, Mr. Chair, before we leave. How much, if something would happen, if we decided to fund a quarter of the things here and something happened in the other three quarters, what would we be liable for? If, I probably a question I should have asked you off record, of course, but I'm just curious, what would the state be liable for? Or would we? Do we have some blanket protection or?
Sovereign immunity?
No. Okay. I'm assuming somebody could be
sued.
Maybe not us, but I'm assuming somebody could be sued
for the things that we can.
Interesting. Interesting.
Take care of.
Break it up by areas. Fairbanks is liable first.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll keep that in mind.
We're south from there.
North
and then south. Our next meeting will be scheduled for March 14th. Is that correct, Leona?
That was just a call.
And we'll take up probably both these two, and
which
we have a couple more, 371 and 324. I do want to talk with, I'll make my rounds and come around and talk to each committee member before the next meeting. And,
14th, you see?
The 14th. And with that, I'll bring the meeting to a close. And once again, thanks, Mike, and thanks, Carol, for being here.